The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Zen Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts.
The original face has nowhere to hide. When the world is destroyed, it is not destroyed. These lines are not from either of the versions of our koan that you've encountered so far, but from a different koan in a later collection, Gateless Gate. And the editor, compiler, Wu Min, writes a poem for each one. And these are the last two lines of the poem for case number 23, Don't Think Good, Don't Think Evil. The original face has nowhere to hide. When the world is destroyed, it is not destroyed. This, I believe, is Wu Min's shout out to our koan. The Blue Cliff record had come out a century before. And it may have been on his mind as he compiled his own collection. And in it, we find two key moments in our koan. The world utterly destroyed, and the hope, the faith, the conviction that something remains, or does it? When I try to find my way into a koan, when I work with it, play with it, I personalize it often. And when I say I personalize it, I mean two things. One is that I begin to identify with, or as David sometimes puts it, dream my way into one or more persons in the koan. Who am I if I'm saying this? Where am I coming from? And the second way I personalize it is I relate it to things in my personal past that may help me find my way emotionally into the world of this koan. Because this is not something we can do with our brains. This is something that we do with our heart minds. And I find it helpful to engage my heart mind by just chance correspondences with my own life. And so I'll do that a bit for you. And it may seem that we're taking some detours away from our koan. And I just want to say that for me, the way into and through a koan is rarely a straight line. So here's our koan as it appears in our version, the one we use in koan study of the Blue Cliff record, case 29, Das Wei's Kalpa Fire. A monk said to Das Wei, when the thousands of universes are all together and utterly destroyed in the Kalpa Fire, I wonder whether this perishes or not. This perishes, said Das Wei. If so, persisted the monk, does it follow the other? It follows the other, said Das Wei. I feel emotion in this koan. I don't think this is a kind of philosophical question for the monk. I think it's personal for the monk. This I've been thinking about and sitting with this notion of the universe or the thousands of universes, the multiverse that was already there 3,000 years ago. The thousands of universes being all together and utterly destroyed in a fire. Why do people think about this? How did we come up with this idea? What does it say about us as human beings that we imagine the absolute end of the world in fire? And we do. It's not just Buddhist cosmology. This notion of a kalpa fire was shared in India with adherents of what would now be called the Hindu religions or religion. And the Hindu version of the kalpa is 4,320 million years, 432. Again, that kalpa, that really long kalpa, ends in fire. Zoroastrianism had its own fiery end to the world. as did the Norse myths of the Vikings, Esther's ancestors, who had their Ragnarok myth of a fiery end of both the heavens and the earth together. And of course, Christianity, with its book of Revelation, with its apocalypse, has often inspired forebodings or maybe kind of excited premonitions of the end of the world in fire. God destroyed the world the first time with water in the flood. The second time, it will be by fire, says Peter the fisherman. We have lived through these forebodings ourselves. We're all old enough to remember the turn of the millennium, 1999 to 2000, when various doomsday cults were springing up. And you, like me, may have read some of the news coverage that talked about, well, 1000 was way worse. If you were worried about doomsday cults, everybody was joining one in 1000. And then it turned out there were many, many periods since the death of Jesus when people thought that that was it, that the book of Revelation, those events were at hand. And again, including in our own lifetime. I remember as a teenager, I was roaming a bookstore downtown Seattle, Shorey's, this huge cavernous used a new bookstore. And my eye caught the title of a book that was called Will You Be Alive in 1965? And given that it was 1970 at the time, I could only say, yes. And a couple of years later, my parents were caught up in this wave of a fundamentalist revival that was going on in America in the 70s. And they already Christians, they became born again Christians and began believing literally in the truth of the Bible every page. And they became enamored of this book called The Late Great Planet Earth by Hal Lindsey, which was a huge bestseller, by the way. A lot of people were interested in this. And Hal Lindsey argued in scrupulous detail that all these things were coming to pass that were prophesied in the book of Revelation. And not in 20 years, but maybe in 20 months, that was going to be it. And you'd better get ready because that great fire was coming. And my parents loved this book. And they were oddly excited about it. My dad talked about it all the time. I had to hear all these details about what was happening in Israel and the common market. And it was hard to take. And you know, they were convinced that the world was ending, and they were psyched about it. The second coming was coming any second, and they were going to be part of it. And they got kind of delusional about it. I was 17 at the time. That's when I left my parents' house for good. I couldn't live that way. I couldn't live with people who I felt had joined a cult. Then I went to San Francisco Zen Center, and they thought I joined a cult. So they got their revenge, I guess. And yet, now I'm going to admit that I, too, in my own way, thought that the world might end in fire, but for a very different reason, for reasons that have everything to do with our commemoration on Saturday, that in the past 80 years, since we, the United States of America, unleashed these horrors on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, in that 80 years, inevitably, other nations developed their own atomic bombs and then hydrogen bombs, and an arms race began. And as a child, I was made highly aware of this. And you know this, right? Every baby boomer has this story about being a child and this kind of, not quite hysteria, not quite panic, but just this huge national anxiety about nuclear holocaust. And unlike, I think, every other boomer in America, I do not remember doing drills where we hid under our desks practice hiding from the debris of the first wave of bombs, thinking that we would be protected by this piece of presswood and linoleum over our heads. But what I do remember quite clearly is my dad's going about taking it upon himself to turn our inner basement into what he called the bomb shelter. And I would go down and work with my dad on this project. And I loved working with my dad. And I would be down there and we would be placing cinder blocks and pasting mortar on them. It was really fun. And I can still smell the mortar. And I can still smell the delicious, musty, earthy smell of the inner basement with its packed dirt floor. And this was supposed to, again, it's kind of like the desks at school. These three layers of cinder blocks were supposed to keep us alive long enough to outfox a nuclear attack. I would go down sometimes by myself and look at the stuff Dad was packing down there. It wasn't like cool survivalist stuff like they have now. It was this like third-rate camping stuff and lots of cans of beans. It was a little bit like the Sashin kitchen that way. And I guess the idea was that for several weeks we would be heating up cans of beans on these Sterno stoves while we were waiting for the radioactive dust to settle and then go out into what? As a child, my father gave up on this project. I don't know if it's because he realized how ridiculous it was or just ran out of energy for it. Maybe at a certain point, we all knew that wasn't going to help. This was all happening after the Cuban Missile Crisis, where it really seemed like we might get a taste of our own medicine. And nuclear weapons might rain down on America. And as a child, I would sometimes hear a plane at night, and I would think, is this it? They're lying awake in my bed. And to be honest with you, sometimes to this day, I'll hear a jet at an odd time of day or in an odd place, someplace I don't think it belongs, and I'll think, is it starting? I still do that. Because isn't that how it'll start, with the whine of a jet high above? So I've lived with this sense of the world ending in fire. And so I can empathize with this monk. I think it really upsets the monk that the world that the monk knows, the world that he's comfortable with, the world where he's practiced the Dharma, where his monastery is, that it will all be gone one day. And so he goes to his teacher for some kind of reassurance. A monk said to Das Wei, when the thousands of universe are all together and utterly destroyed in the Kalpa fire, I wonder whether this perishes or not. For my parents, the end of the world in fire wasn't really a big deal because there was another place to go. They would go to heaven, maybe without dying. They would be part of that generation that got to go straight up, the rapture. And I can guarantee you that there are many people in America who think this right now. This is not some weird arcane belief we've left behind. And some of them are helping to run our government. And you know, guess what? Global warming, environmental degradation, not really a problem if the world is going to be destroyed by fire and you'll find yourself in the New Jerusalem. So this is a strange place to be. But for our monk, there's nothing. There's no heaven. All this, the six worlds that you keep hearing about, all the six realms, they all go together. All the universes, utterly, everything gone. No hell realm, no hungry ghosts, no deva realm, no gods, everything gone. Does anything last? And I can understand this too. This wish for something that you can hang on to, for some place that you can look to for serenity, for some kind of confidence. And so he says, I wonder, I've been wondering a lot, whether this perishes or not. So this is the second for me kernel of the koan. This one actually has two, the great kalpa fire and this, whether this perishes or not. And so I've been sitting with this, and how does the monk understand this? What is the monk reaching towards? What is the monk trying to say by not saying? And so imagining myself into the monk's flesh and bones and brain, I imagine the monk sitting with this, maybe for years. In Korea, some monks sit for years with what is this? And I'm wondering if already in 12th century China, people were sitting with what is this? Was he sitting with what is this as a kind of wado, which was explained to us yesterday, the core part of a koan. What is this? Or just some phrase from a koan, like only just this. It, as to the last word, it's only just this, only just this. And has the monk, through sitting with this, with just this, with what is this, has the monk found something that escapes all of his usual categories of thought that can't be located inside him or outside him, that can't be put into words, that can't be passed down as a tradition? Has he happened on something? Has this become part of who he is and how he practices? And what if this perishes? What if this goes? And asking for some kind of reassurance for something he can hang on to, I believe. That's how I'm reading the koan. We'll all read it differently, and maybe tomorrow I will too. But looking for some place to rest. I wonder whether this perishes or not. This perishes, says Dasue. Kind of awe-inspiring, the way that Dasue just takes it away, just wipes it away. This perishes. And then kind of sad, almost pathetic, the way the monk persists. You mean, are you saying that this follows the other? It follows the other. Yeah. No way out. So something that I've been sitting with too is, why does this koan leave us in this place? In this place with nothing to hang on to, not even this. Not even only just this. How does this speak to our practice? Does this resonate in our deepest hearts? What has Dasue given to his student and to us? And then, what does it mean that later another teacher says, no, it doesn't perish? Why is that taken away too? There's a line in our sutra book that's, and I can't remember it as well as I'd like to at this moment, but it's, you know, such and such is extinguished, and then extinguishing is wiped away. and that's what this feels like to me. So how does it feel to you? A monk said to Das Wei, when the thousands of universes are all together and utterly destroyed in the Kalpa fire, I wonder whether this perishes or not. This perishes, said Das Wei. If so, persisted the monk, does it follow the other? It follows the other, said Das Wei. Thank you. So please feel free to sit comfortably and we'll make our U. And I invite you all to come forward with open hearts and open minds, and my fellow teachers will help me to respond to your remarks. Tom.
So, the last thing, thank you for your dream of how to enter that koan. Really resonated. So, the extinguishing is also extinguished. In other words, it's all over. Somehow, that sounds good to me. So, yeah.
Yeah, congratulations.
There's sorrow in it.
Yeah,
but
right.
But it's still, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think this is what Alan was saying, that we say, oh, no, but yet some part of us longs for the great Kalpa fire. Burn it up, burn it, burn everything down, right? This, you know, and other feelings too, but so interesting to go in this way, to acknowledge, I could use a good Kalpa fire.
Well, right, because we really work so hard to maintain our self stories.
Mm.
And I have this, when you said that, my heart just went, yes. Because I feel the same way. Oh, wouldn't it be a relief to not do that work of maintaining the self anymore? And this is what the great mystics, you know, we've been talking about this, this is what they say. You know, Rumi says, be in love with your burning. And that's how it feels sometimes. And there's a little poignancy, maybe. Sadness, as you say.
And, you know, this construction is so hard to maintain. And that I feel, in your words, the relief. Like, I can let it go.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
I'm
going to
lay down my word.
Yeah.
Yes! Hello.
Thank you, Tom. Yeah, Todd.
Yeah, I also appreciate the talk, Alan, and appreciate the extinguishing. So, you know, we really are letting go, and you know, opening the hand of thought and refraining from clinging to anything, and we're also refraining from clinging to an idea, any idea of this or that. So it really is this don't know, this mystery. I guess maybe we'll find out. Maybe we won't.
But you know, it's not about some future time.
Right.
But to even say, maybe we'll find out. Find out now.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Really take these instructions to heart.
Mm-hmm.
Lay down your burdens. What would that be like right now? Maybe we'd miss them. I don't know. My burden, my stone. The great cartoon of the guy holding onto a big boulder, sinking down to the bottom of the ocean.
saying, my stone, my stone. What would I do without my stone? My precious.
Thanks, Todd. Will.
I had a different question that was, but I'm now moved to say that I really hear a difference, Alan, between the way you spoke and actually the way the koan literally speaks and the way it's been talked about here in general. That is to say, the koan appears to be about the end of the world, and even, you know, if the monk has been sitting with justice just now, the monk is actually, I mean, it's odd to me that he has doubt, but maybe that's normal, you know, but there's something not really doubtable about this here now, but whatever, we waver. But he's not explicitly at talking about the self, but, you know, when Melissa just now spoke and Michael, there's a kind of automatic elision, but of course he means the self. So I just wanted to kind of point that out, that the text isn't about the self. It appears to be about the end of everything we know, right? And I can, of course, see that everything we know is, you know, relational. The self is always relational, so we're always, you know, reflecting on ourselves. But I felt like just putting that out there, right, that it feels different to me to worry about the fate of the planet as opposed to, you know, whatever it means to lose this, to see through the self.
Yeah, and first I want to thank you for changing your question to one that was touching.
Yeah.
I really appreciate that.
Yeah.
And second, I want to say, you know, the reason you've heard it different ways is because we teach as different teachers.
Yeah, yeah.
And we don't all get together and come up with
a
party
line. Yeah,
I wasn't
complaining.
No,
just
I know.
Pointing out.
And I'm saying we do this on purpose.
Yeah.
You know, we let our differences, our different approaches emerge. And then put them on display for you all to react to. And you know, it. So as you were speaking, what I wanted to say is that in some ways, right, the world is being utterly and completely destroyed as we sit in Zazen, as everything that we see as certain falls away, right, to quote an unlikely person, Marx, right, all that is solid melts away. And that can happen, you know, but what about this? What about this? Does this melt away too? So in some ways you could say that the monk is talking about the experience of what we call, you know, absolute emptiness, everything falling away. And well, but is there this residue? Is there this remainder? Interesting question.
And I think part of the joy of these koans is it is not this as opposed to that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I appreciate you turning, naming that. It's this. Oh, I get it now. It's this. Oh, but it's not that. It's
mm-hmm.
this whole other thing. And I think how we can talk about the same four lines for 7 days
mm-hmm.
It is because of this quality of dreaming and association,
mm-hmm.
Using this as a touchstone to bring everything in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we don't have to worry about which is the correct, mm-hmm. right, beyond that. So, thank you.
And there's another koan where a student asks a teacher about the world, and the teacher responds, "What do you call the world?"
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And lays it out. What do you consider? What do you call the world?
Thank you, Will. Did you have a hand up, Paul? Okay, Anne.
Well, there's something so odd and abstract about it. I mean, a final fire would hurt. It's instead, it's like disappearing. It's like confronting a basic fear with no reality to it.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And even your father didn't count up how many cans he'd need for how many.
No, he didn't.
It's just so whoosh without any physicality to it, which is sort of
Yeah, I was not trying to present it that way. You know, when I was a little boy in my bed and I thought that the bomb was going to drop on me, because this is how we were socialized. Mm-hmm. This was part of the culture. But Cuban Missile Crisis happened when I was 7. You know, and that's what really got people afraid. And I did not think it would just be proof. And you know, we'd seen some pictures from Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It did not look like it was painless or as quick as you might imagine. Yeah. But sure, there might be a tendency to talk about it that way. Yeah. And you know, I mentioned the whole rapture thing, which is a big thing. There's a whole series of books about the rapture. I don't know if you know that. Yeah. You know, the whole fantasy of the rapture is avoiding that. You don't have to die. Just beam me up, sky. You know, just get sucked up to heaven. And that's where the real evasion is. Yeah.
I was going to say, I really trust your instincts here, Anne, because I think when a koan feels abstract to us, that's a sign that maybe we haven't hit the wado of it yet, right? It's always quite personal, and if it leads us into speculation and contemplation and thinking, same thing, right? This abstract, because we don't know what it's going to be like when the bomb falls. You know, I think about the people who were buried at Mount Vesuvius in Pompeii. We don't know. You know, we only can make stuff up. And I sure still, you know, especially after the awareness lately because of the 80th anniversary, and that, you know, any bomb will destroy the whole world eventually. Mm-hmm. Just, you know, just might take a couple of days, but it's over. I go back to childhood too, and when I hear that plane going overhead from the Worcester Airport, just a normal going to New York thing, but I'm not expecting it. I don't usually hear it then. I have that sudden, oh, here it is. So I think that for me the important thing is to keep associating it, which is what I think Alan was doing, associate it to our actual practice here and now. Keep associating, dreaming, you know, remembering, but make it real. If it's abstract, you know, who cares? Go to the library, read some books. But to do this, you know, we're reading the Book of the Heart, and it has responses that are trustworthy. The mind's not so trustworthy. Many of us have learned that. But boy, the heart is trustworthy. And of course, it's not trustworthy either, right? It's all the emotions come and go, too. But moment after moment, making it real. Really. However you can do that. And thank you.
Thanks, Aaron. Michael.
Oh. Okay.
Michael and then Ray.
My reaction to the koan was to sort of look for a coal shovel in me and say, how do I start shoveling myself, right? My habits and these good and bad things onto the fire. But what you said today and about a reality of the earth on fire. On Saturday, I was seeing before me a Japanese graphic novel that I adore. It's called Barefoot Gen, and there are several volumes, written from a bias survivor, a Japanese comic artist, from the perspective of children of Hiroshima and, you know, life after. And it's graphic and sad, and then what you said today, I was brought to tears thinking about my kids. Mm. You know, those just beautiful teens, you know, and the Danish authorities, the preparedness authorities right now are, you know, telling us to buy iodine and fill water jugs and, you know, and it's a very difficult spot for a father to stand and say, what do I do with these? What do I do with this advice? What do I, both the koan and these authorities, with the reality that facing that reality?
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, not just our children, but the temple, our gardens, you know, what do we do? And I think what we do is, you know, we go out and we transplant another plant, like Tabor was doing yesterday. We remember to call are your children adults?
13, yes. 17.
So, you know, we make an extra call and see how they're doing and hear all about their soccer game and or their football game. And you know, and just let ourselves feel the preciousness of something that may be gone in any moment.
And I think too, Michael, you're pointing to something that's very essential in Zen practice, which is, do we face it all or do we turn away? And so, you know, in a way, the Danish government is responding, and I've talked to friends in Belgium, similar stuff, to the war in Ukraine, which is not too far away. It's not even that far away from us anymore, but it's definitely not far away from Denmark and Belgium and France. And so, you know, to say, get some iodine, set aside water, it can seem like what Alan's dad was doing, but it can also seem like, okay, let's face things. Yet we can go overboard, right? And because even though I want burning, as Rumi says, maybe not right now. You know, I think I'd rather look at Netflix. You know, just that we have to keep going back and forth. Even here at Sesshin, on our cushions, on our chairs, in practice, turning towards what's here, and then sometimes it's just overwhelming. And so we have to, you know, so both are required, but how much? And will one cause panic? It's such a hard question. Yeah, so I love that you brought this in.
And yet it triggered the bittersweet.
Yes.
You know, feelings about my kids that
exactly.
They'll be without me, I'll be without them.
Yeah.
This is, you know, it's a gift to be in contact with.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. That's it.
Thank you, Michael. Ray.
Yeah, thank you for your talk. It makes me value practice all the more. It's like life, you know, I grew up to the same parents that you did, and it's been one terrifying challenge after another, from the Cold War to the Vietnam War to the nuclear war to, you know, wars. It's kept me wrapped up in fear about what to do. And for many years I was an activist, but it was driven by fear. And it's this lifelong preoccupation with the inevitable, the fragility of life. And it's, it could potentially end at any time out of my control. And so this has kind of been, for me, I think, the drive to, at some point, I need to meet this fear. You know, it's like life gives me one opportunity after another to meet it, and how do I meet it? And it was finally with the Zen practice that I could turn around and face that fear, and face that pain, that threat, the insecurity of this and fragility of being a human being and all the suffering that inevitably can happen, and that one fears. For me, it's been, okay, where to go to meet that fear and not let it take over, not let it control, not rob me of my peace, of my true nature.
Yeah, thank you, Ray. And when you spoke of the fragility of life, you know, something I heard in that, and it's not necessarily anything that was in you, is that you know, this koan is also about our own personal death, because the whole world will vanish when we die. You know, and I wonder if part of this apparently global tendency to imagine the fiery end of the whole universe is kind of projection of the fact that we're the only animal that knows that it will die. And, you know, why not take everything with us? why not make it a much bigger story? And that fragility, that even if we didn't have these nuclear weapons, even if we didn't have these myths and religious beliefs in an end by fire, we would still have that sense of our fragility. So. And still need to respond in ways that you were demonstrating for us.
And the facing the fear, not to get someplace else, but not to be driven, what I hear you saying, we can be controlled by the demons of fear or anger or whatever it is, but to discern what is this? I will not run away, and we meet the world, and we don't overcome the world, we don't get to someplace else, but right in the middle, the heart of that, this practice of not running away, of staying, you know, requiring, as we say over and over again, great courage and love, and each one of us brought up face to face with it, this is the great opportunity. And I also have to say, sort of tying in what Michael was saying, this image, Alan, of you with your dad, we're building something down in the basement. I mean, in some way, all driven by your dad's fear. But what a sweet moment that you carry with you, the smell of the dirt, and yeah, we're building something here. Right in the middle of it, not after it was over, and not because your dad was so bright he was doing the right thing, but because of it all. Yeah.
Thank you, Ray. Deb?
What came up for me was, I think you talking about your childhood, was my family of origin was Jewish, and when I learned about the Holocaust, I had this feeling like, wow, that is us. You know, I mean, we lived in New York, but, you know, we could have been in Europe. We could have been in Germany, and that could have been us being incinerated. And I'm just, like, struck by, it feels like now this is still happening. And I mean, I don't identify as Jewish, and my family was more culturally Jewish rather than religious. But anyway, that's,
Yeah.
This is the thing, you know, belonging to the two nose hole society as we do. Everyone has connections to people who've been incinerated, whether we're Jewish or not. Human beings are very cruel to each other. All of us have forebears who suffered greatly, and in the present moment, people are suffering greatly because of other people's cruelty. And to see that it's a possibility, you know, I found out about the Holocaust around the same time I read John Hersey's book about Hiroshima. You know, it's like, wait a minute, I thought life was really meant to be happy. What had this stuff? And then, of course, more and more gets revealed. Read any history, learn about any other country, this is happening. And so I think that
the thing that's changed, I think, more than anything right now is that more people are awake to the possibility of something that has always happened. And that's why I feel like it's so essential for us to keep facing it. You know, I think what Ray said about fear can be the motivator. But once we turn into the fear, we become courageous, right? That's what Esther was saying in her talk. And to have courage, to have heartfulness. We sometimes talk about courageous bodhisattvas. That's like a phrase, a cliche phrase in Buddhism. What does that mean? Well, that means just what we're talking about. Here it is. What is it? And really, is it going to go away? Yep. But maybe, could I bargain? So thank you for bringing that in, because it's really relevant right now. And it's always been relevant.
And in the Diamond Sutra, the Buddha called his disciples blessed and courageous bodhisattvas. So both the blessing of being here and the courage of being here for many thousands of years now.
Thank you, Deb. So maybe one more response? Yeah?
Thank you for your talk. For all the talks, the koan, I think almost right away brought to mind the Robert Frost poem "Fire and Ice," and I just want to bring that in too, if I may. You know, some say the world will end in fire, some say in ice. I just think I've seen enough. I'm sorry.
From what I've tasted.
From what I've tasted of desire, I hold with those who favor fire, although I think I've seen enough of hate to know that for destruction, ice is also great and would suffice. And what I appreciate about that is he's talking about the world ending, but he's talking about us. He's talking about the personal. And so that's another piece I think that I hear in this is... you know, it's also our destructive capacity, our rage, our, you know, wanting things to end or wanting to get even, all of that. And it's looking at that too, as well as the fear and all of that, but looking at, you know, not separating from that.
Yeah, beautifully said, Matt. And I heard the voice of the ghost this time.
Right. When it's so connected to what Anne was saying, right? This is not abstract stuff. Ouch. It hurts, it hurts. And it's ours. It's very personal. And of course it's all of humanity together in this. Yeah. Remember the Buddha taught that suffering is a feature, not a glitch. This is, and to face that.
And the end of the world is personal.
Yeah. Thank you, everyone. So let's restore the Zendo.